obsession, and a new shell could form and harden around it. Faith had read that Annie was religious. Had she found religion as a way to manage her thoughts about the abortion? Or maybe it was something else entirely. If Faith could see her now, she would say, "Annie, really?" Decades later, the team at Loci repeatedly tried to get Senator McCauley to come speak at a summit. The first time they tried, Faith had said nothing, tensely waiting to see what would happen, what Annie would do. The senator's office predictably said she would be unable to come. That was probably for the best. Because even if Faith had gotten her alone in a room and said, "Annie, really?" Annie would certainly have replied, "Yes, Faith, really." They both believed what they believed. Their convictions filled them fully. But just as Annie would never reveal her own history publicly, Faith wouldn't reveal it either. It wasn't her information to give. It was private. "I get to decide," the women had sung at that gathering. Despite everything, Faith never told anyone. Faith became aware fairly early on of her skill at bringing out certain qualities in other women. They wanted to be in her midst, and they wanted more from themselves. She realized that girls and young women actually loved her in ways that were similar to how Lincoln did. They could seem a little lost, or perhaps in need of inspiration. Perhaps the most important thing she gave them, she realized, was permission. "Tell me what you want from life, Olive," she'd said to a shy girl, a high school intern at Bloomer. Olive Mitchell looked at her gratefully, as if she'd waited 16 years to be asked that question. "Aerospace engineering," she said breathlessly. "Excellent. Well, then pursue that with your whole self. I suspect it's tough to break into that field, right?" The girl nodded. "So you'll need to be entirely tenacious and unimpeachable, which I know you already are. I believe you can do it," she added. It had been years since Faith had thought of Olive, but she knew that she had gone on to study aerospace engineering, for she'd written Faith a letter of extreme, nearly poetic thanks, with a photo of her standing in a research lab, smiling with unalloyed happiness. That was so long ago. It was hard to keep track of the young women Faith had met, so many of them shining and shot through with promise. Young women came and went through Faith Frank's door wherever she lived and whatever she did. Inevitably, some of them were close at hand, and she wasn't often severely lonely. Sometimes over the years, she experienced a very particular desire for the company of a man, and when that happened, Faith would arrange to meet up with Will Kelly, a Democratic strategist she'd met at a function in the late 1980s. Handsome, hangdog, bushy-mustached, never married, he had a kind of policy wonk slash beachcomber mix to him that she found seductive. Though he lived in Austin, Texas, Will would fly up to be with Faith. They would have dinner and a night of companionable, somewhat aerobic sex and good conversation. Then it might not happen again for months, and this was fine. Being alone was something that Faith had perfected over the years. When you were alone, you didn't have to worry about every little detail on your body, whether your legs were like prickly pears or whether after a cocktail party you were brie-breathed. Unlike many people she knew, she often preferred her own company. When Bloomer folded in 2010, it was a blow of all kinds. For months, Faith felt down, unneeded, and then suddenly that billionaire ghost from her past, Emmett Schrader, telephoned, or anyway his assistant did, and Faith agreed to come to his office for a lunchtime meeting. When she arrived, a table had been set in his enormous British men's club of an office with the startling views. Emmett stood and walked toward her as she entered. She'd seen various photos of him over the years, had watched his hair change from dark to silver. A few times, she'd Googled him. From the doorway, she saw that he still had no fat on him, but remained lean in the way that a billionaire with a trainer and a butler and a health-conscious cook can do. But when he came closer, Faith became aware of a different feeling, a nostalgia for Emmett's lost younger self, coupled with a nostalgia for her own lost younger self. Together, the two nostalgias combined to create something that was immediately emotional and even very slightly sexual in nature. Standing there, she had the general sensation of want, though she couldn't immediately determine what it was she wanted. Did she want him? Or did she want younger him, and along with that, younger her? Did she just want to be young again, period? She recalled the night they had spent in bed, and then its unhappy, crashing postlude. His face was still strong, and a word came to mind, a word associated with power. Craggy, though God forbid a female public figure should become craggy. They'd mock her on Twitter, say she'd let herself go and she should put a bag over her head. His body was still tight and impressive, encased in the beautiful clothes of the very wealthy male, the tie hanging like an icicle. Sexual attraction was not an island. It was part of an archipelago that included trappings and context. He was in the context of his ridiculously massive office and of the years he had lived since they'd seen each other last, racking up his victories like a big game hunter. "Faith," he said, and his voice was soft, his eyes almost wet. He took her hand, but then let go and put both arms around her. The hug was surprising, so different from the air kisses or the double air kisses that were ubiquitous on the island of Manhattan. The hug was genuine, and it was a relief. "I am so glad to see you," Emmett said when they released and pulled back and looked at each other. Then he sat her down on a brown leather couch the size of a buffalo, and he sat across from her. She listened as he spun the tale of a women's foundation that he wanted his firm to underwrite and that he wanted her to run. "We will hold summits, lectures, huge gatherings around a chosen topic and invite the public." "We won't solicit outside funding," he said. "We'll charge for tickets, but beyond that, all the costs will be ours." "Slow down," Faith finally said when he had spoken uninterrupted for several minutes. In the background, men and women dressed in white prepared the lunch table. "First of all, I want to say I'm very flattered." "Don't say that," he said. "People say that when they're about to say no to something." "Well, before I came in here today, I asked around and tried to get some more context," Faith said. "You've been stellar in so many ways, Emmett, and yet you've also been known to take the moral shortcut." "Look, Faith, my firm is involved with many projects," he said. "I haven't been sainted, that's true. We try a lot of things, and not everything works, but we're doing very well. And if you look at our donation history, I think you'll be reassured. We give a lot to women's causes." They looked at each other in silence for a hair-raising amount of time. She wanted to unnerve him, even as she was sitting there. "You care about women's lives?" she finally asked. "I think you know the answer to that." "Remember John Hinckley?" she said. "The guy who shot Ronald Reagan? He said he did it to impress Jodie Foster."
"You think I'm offering you this to impress you?"
"Maybe.
Even if that were the case, which it's not, let me assure you that this foundation will involve the maiming of no presidents," said Emmett.
He rubbed his eyes as if she were exhausting him, and probably she was. Maybe he was wishing he'd never called her in, for she was being such a pain in the ass. But she had to see this through.
"Look," he said, "I only want to do something good."
"Something that involves women?"
"Well, yes."
Then, her voice quieter, she added, "Something that involves me." Faith was overexcited at the thought of having access to the kind of money and resources that Emmett was offering. She'd never had any of it before, and she'd never thought to want it. She could hardly imagine what it would be like. Back at Bloomer, they'd had to fight with Cormor Publishing to pay writers even a small amount, or to get 2-ply toilet paper in the restroom.
She wondered if, in accepting the offer, she would be selling out. Shirley Pepper was long dead from coronary artery disease. She couldn't ask her. Bonnie Dempster, ever since Bloomer folded, had been making a very unpredictable living working for a small, all-women home decluttering company called, embarrassingly, Stuffragettes. After the meeting in Emmett's office, she told him she'd have to think about it. Faith called her to get her opinion, and it was Bonnie who said to Faith, "Well, you do tend to be a little gullible, Faith. It's great that you're not cynical, but I would be careful. Also, is this something you'd actually love to do? I mean, is it good enough?" Faith called Emmett the next morning and said, "You know, I'm not sure we'd really be making a difference. It would be a kind of high-end lecture bureau, and that is not something I've had experience with, or wanted to." He was quiet. "How would we connect with women?" she asked. "How would we change people's lives?" "I'm telling you, we would. You would." "Thank you," she said after a long moment. "But I'm going to have to say no." He seemed shocked, and the call quickly ended. Faith went for a long walk in Riverside Park, trudging along, thinking of what she had just turned down. It was hollow to her, what he was offering. What more would she need? What would make it good enough? An hour later, she got into a cab and returned to his office without an appointment. He was there, and when she was shown into his office again, she said, "There would have to be another component."
"Tell me," Emmett said.
"Every day I hear stories about the plight of women all over the world. I would like to think that in addition to providing speakers, we could also get out there and do something. If we find an emergency situation where we feel we could be of some immediate help, I'd like to have funds made available to take action so that women could see relief right away." She looked at him. "Are you already dismissing this?"
"Of course not."
"We could be, say, 80% about speakers and summits, but 20% about what we could call, I don't know, special projects."
"Deal," he said.
Over time, both arms of Loci, those uneven arms, had been highly productive. Women were forever summiting, endlessly climbing with ropes around the waist, wielding pitons. The summits were about ambitious topics, such as, recently, leadership. Leadership being something that everyone now wanted, as if the world could be made up entirely of leaders and no followers, the way children might crave an all-fireman, all-ballerina society. And there had been a good number of those special projects over the years. Loci had paid the salary to employ a community health worker in a rural village in Namibia, and had paid for the defense of a woman on trial for the murder of her husband, who had abused and terrorized her for a decade. But by 2014, over 4 years in now, it had become precipitously harder to get any of the ideas for the special projects that Loci presented past the people upstairs. These projects, you could tell, were a nuisance to them, a money pit. It wasn't just that Schrader Capital had become stingier since the start of Loci. It had, but there was also outside resistance to some of the work. "Africa doesn't need your help," someone wrote in an influential online magazine, and it kept getting reposted elsewhere, replicating endlessly. Faith was used to being criticized, and to being hated. There had always been some of that back in the height of the Bloomer years. But on Twitter, at the inception of Loci, people wrote hashtag blood money and hashtag faithless Frank. And then soon the concern became less about Faith's collaboration with Emmett Schrader than it was about the foundation itself. But by now it was clear not only that Loci hadn't kept up with all the galloping changes in feminism, but that the way it presented itself was also a reason for vilification. Loci was doing good business, and naturally people were writing things on Twitter like hashtag white lady feminism and hashtag rich ladies, and the hashtag that for some reason irritated Faith most, hashtag finger sandwich feminism. She understood their complaints. She really did. There was so much waste with these events and receptions at which they were now supposed to seduce other corporations and big donors. People complained, with justification, that they shouldn't have to give money to a foundation that was backed by a billionaire. And Losi was never supposed to have had to seek outside funding. Schrader Capital had been covering all costs. But that had changed inexplicably. Emmett had gotten pressure from within. So Losi at this moment in time was an uneasy hybrid. She'd adapted to the 21st century to a degree, but what she knew how to do best, she had learned back in the beginning. The beginning had been the profound place for her, the pit, the root. Despite the hazing on Twitter and elsewhere, the summits were doing so well, and the people upstairs had been weighing in more frequently and conducting studies and focus groups. Because of their input, the foundation had been encouraged to go celebrity-heavy. Lincoln had noticed, and so had most people. A shallowness had crept in. Too much of what happened at these events was just frivolous, Faith knew. That had rarely been the case in the beginning. Some of the team seemed demoralized. Months earlier, like a doctor on grand rounds, Faith had gone around to check in on them, and soon realized morale was dangerously low. When she got to the cubicle of Greer Kadetsky, who'd been at Losi since nearly the start, to her surprise, she found Greer with her head down on the surface of her desk, lightly asleep at 11 in the morning. Greer was usually focused and sharp, though lately that was less true. Lately, she could be seen whispering with the others, dissatisfied by the memos that came down from upstairs. Faith had been trying to pretend that the changes at Losi were not close to reaching a point of no return, but she couldn't keep it up, and she knew she shouldn't keep it up either. "Good morning, sleepyhead," Faith said softly, remembering that this was the way she had awakened Lincoln for school when he slept through his alarm. There had been cloaked irritation in her words then, as there was now, and Greer was mortified.
"Faith, I'm so sorry."
She sat up quickly and reached up as if to smooth out her face. "Sleeping on the job? That's not typical. Is it really so bad here now?" Faith asked. "Maybe it is," she added. Then, "Grab some coffee and come talk to me in my office, Greer." Sitting on the white couch and squinting in a band of sunlight, Greer said, "I didn't really have that much going on this morning. At least not that much that needed my immediate attention. That's the way it's gotten for me. It just feels so corporate lately. There's so much attention to money now that we're supposed to solicit funds. I thought Schrader Capital was paying for everything. I miss the way it used to be," Greer said bluntly. "When it was smaller. I miss writing speeches for those lunch talks." "You did a great job with them. I'm sorry they got phased out. Not my decision." "And I also miss the way those women used to come into the office, and I sat with them with my little tape recorder, and I got to know them, and I saw what it was we were doing. I saw it. It was right in front of me. Someone's life." "As you know, I agree with everything you're saying."
"I'm not sure we're doing anything, Faith," Greer said. "I like to think we are," she added quickly. "It's hard to know how much we ever did, quantifiably. We don't have a product. And I know that from a money standpoint, we're a huge success now, and when we started, we weren't. But I feel like we're in a rut. Or anyway, I am."
All Faith had to do was poke at it a little bit, and Greer told her everything she felt. She'd always been this way, and it was no different now, though now she spoke less haltingly. Like the others, at least the ones who had been there since the beginning, Greer Kadetsky disliked the glitter of the foundation, the fact that she never directly got to help anyone. Greer still did a lot of writing, strong writing, Faith thought, but it was all for the newsletter or the annual report, which certainly added to that corporate feel she described.
"And when was the last time we did a special project?" Greer persisted. "They energized everybody here because we could see something happening in real time. Where's our money going, exactly? I know that Emmett funded the foundation so it could be big, so it could be different from your experience at Bloomer. But my understanding of being big is that it means you have an impact, isn't that right? You can tell me to stop talking, Faith, but I just think sometimes there's a self-satisfaction about the whole thing. Not from you, not from us, but from the events themselves. It doesn't feel so good to me these days. Maybe it'll change, but I don't know. So I fell asleep. Sorry, she added.
I know, said Faith. I really do know. And because she couldn't think of anything else to say yet, she put a hand on Greer Kadetsky's shoulder and said, Let me work on it.
Turn over, miss, said a voice, and Faith, marinating deep in her memories, made a grunting sound, returning from all of that to the present moment. She had to take a second to remember what that present moment was. The smell of baby oil struck her first, then the all-string version of You Don't Bring Me Flowers, then the awareness that her face was mashed against a vinyl cradle whose towel had slipped off. The massage had placed her in a stupor. She obediently rolled onto her back, one breast briefly flapping out from the protection of the towel. She opened her eyes and found herself staring, much too close, into the face of her masseuse. It was startling to really take in how young the woman was. She was almost a girl. Maybe she was a girl. Maybe this was child labor. Jesus Christ. Immediately, Faith felt all her muscles contract and the woozy dream state calcified. May I ask your age? Faith asked calmly. The woman looked down.
I am not a girl, she said. I am mom of two, boy and girl. Keep young by working hard.
She laughed dully as though she had been asked this question many times before. Do you like working here? Faith persisted, but the woman didn't answer. This was a question that now preoccupied her. The day after Greer Kadetsky had fallen asleep at work and then expressed her work frustrations, Faith had called a meeting in the conference room, which turned into an hours-long session, like a kind of consciousness-raising group from the past. They had all sat around the table, and she listened as one by one they told her why they had originally come to Losi, and why it felt different there now. They told her about their worries that the summits were elitist, that there was a kind of feel-good feminism in the air. I recognize that feminism can't only be feel bad, said one of the newer hires, a very bright IT person, a trans woman named Kara. But there's too much of an emphasis on how everything feels, one way or another, and less on what it does. This was the refrain, said in various ways. Someone else said that she missed the special projects, and everyone chimed in. Yes, the special projects, which brought immediate results. In a way, Faith knew, another special project might remind them all of what they were doing there. Afterward, Faith had gone upstairs to see Emmett. She couldn't tell him how unhappy everyone was downstairs. That seemed risky. If they're so unhappy, let's end it, she worried someone at Schrader Capital might say. Instead, she told him she had a good idea for a special project. It's been a while, Emmett, she said lightly, but she hoped strongly. Then she described for him the project she had in mind. Again and again at work over the years, there had been bulletins disseminated about human trafficking, an issue around which she felt helpless. Losi had brought in speakers before, but now it felt like it was time to do something more. Ifat Khan, who was now a researcher on the team and no longer Faith's assistant, had shown Faith some material on a situation in the Cotopaxi province in Ecuador, where young women, in many cases girls, were being lured from home and brought to Guayaquil to become prostitutes. It definitely qualified as an emergency. If we can save a number of them, it would shine a light on the larger situation, she said. Maybe other corporate entities and charities would get involved. It could be an ongoing rescue mission. Schrader looked gloomy and unconvinced, so Faith told him the rest of her idea. I was thinking that after the rescue, we could connect these young women with mentors, older women who would teach them useful skills, how to read, first of all, if that's needed, and computer literacy, along with a trade, textiles, maybe. They could learn to knit, and eventually form a textile co-op, a women's textile co-op. Faith was excited by her own idea, polishing those last three words individually as she said them, but Emmett just kept looking at her, unconvinced.
"And then we could bring one of the young women over here to speak about it," Faith said.
"What do you think?"
"What, we would fly her here?"
"Sure, why not?"
Emmett paused, slightly more engaged, and bobbed his head from side to side, considering. He promised to bring it up to the relevant people upstairs, and in June of 2014, a memo came to Faith from upstairs telling her that they were actually going to do it. She was very excited. Mentorship was still a very popular concept right now. Everyone was talking about it, and the idea was surprisingly well received. Someone at Schrader Capital had found a local contact in Quito. Alejandra Sosa was described as a dynamic leader involved with human rights issues in the developing world. Her resume was peppered with acronyms, the names of NGOs with which she'd consulted. All those capital letters, when looked at on one sheet of paper, had the effect of a firewall, or a code that could only be broken by someone much smarter than you. A hasty Skype session was arranged. Members of the Schrader Capital and Loci teams in New York sat around a rock slab of a conference table, up on 27, facing the projected image of a group of women in a modest Quito office.
"Faith Frank," said Alejandra Sosa. "This is an honor of honors. You have been very important to me as a woman."
Sosa was 40 years old and confident, sexy. Faith liked her at once. They exchanged easy conversation about their shared mission. Alejandra Sosa knew of some skilled older women who could be hired to work with the 100 young women and girls after they had been rescued and relocated, to become their mentors. Schrader Capital would fund it, and the agency that Alejandra Sosa oversaw in Quito would take care of distributing money and making arrangements. She was very reassuring, and at the end she said,
"It is gratifying to work with you, Faith Frank. You are a force for good."
Faith had said to Emmett and his team, "I liked her tremendously, but we need to vet her, of course. You hear about the scamming that goes on in aid work when there isn't oversight. I don't want to get caught up in any of that."
"Of course, do what you need to do," said the COO, and in the background one of the assistants piped up, "No worries."
The researchers down on 26 found that Sosa had a record of achieving results. The secretary of the executive board of UNICEF had written her a fulsome, nearly weepy recommendation letter. Then a couple of weeks later, word came that the modest rescue mission had gone well, and that 100 traumatized young women had been paired with older women. The young ones were offered transitional housing in an apartment building in Quito, where they would recover from their ordeal and learn a trade, through which they could make a living and start a new life. Before the end of the year, as Faith had proposed, one of the rescued young women would be brought here to be introduced on stage and say a few words after the keynote at the Mentorship Summit coming up soon in L.A. Faith had already begun working on the keynote, but now, deep into October, lying on this table, naked, under a towel, having her body indelicately pushed and pulled, she thought, "I should turn the keynote over to Greer Kadetsky. Let her not only write it, but also deliver it." Greer was forward-looking, smart, and passionate. She had the ability to listen well and draw people out. They connected with her and trusted her. Look at those wonderful lunchtime speeches she had written. Plus, Greer was on the verge of becoming her own person, and this would help push her further. She would get to write two speeches, one for the young woman from Ecuador and one for herself. In her own speech, she would finally be speaking as Greer Kadetsky. Faith understood that Greer had hit that plateau that comes several years into a new position. She needed proof that her work mattered, not just a nebulous hope that it did. Otherwise, she would continue to feel discouraged, and also she would be in danger of leaving. What if they all leave? Faith thought. Of course, there would always be someone else who would come. People left now and again. Helen Brand had left last month to be a national reporter for the Washington Post. No one was ever irreplaceable. And yet she always felt a pang, like a kind of brief grief when someone left, followed by a slight start,
almost an increase in respiration rate when someone new arrived. "Give it to Greer," she told herself. Faith recalled one specific conversation with Greer Kadetsky, way back in the earliest days. Greer had called her up, crying, and had told her that there had been a tragedy in her personal life, and she couldn't make it to the very first summit, which they'd all been working toward around the clock. A child had been killed, Faith remembered. Greer's boyfriend's brother? But it was so long ago that she couldn't recall the details. She just remembered Greer's voice on the phone saying, "Faith?" And then the tears, and how she, Faith, had immediately gone into soothing mode. As soon as she got off the phone with Greer, she was on another call, scrambling, yelling a little to find someone to take up the slack. That was what it was like, running a foundation. You soothed and you scrambled, and sometimes you yelled. And then one day, sometime later, Faith had overheard Greer speaking to someone in a pleading voice on her cell phone. Faith had come over to her, concerned, and asked if she was all right. Greer looked up, nodding, but she didn't look all right. That afternoon, Greer had come to Faith's office door. This was no surprise. All the young women eventually showed up at Faith's door, and she came in and planted herself on the couch and told Faith everything. She and the high school boyfriend had had a rough breakup. "I don't know what to do," Greer had said. "We've been together for so long, and it wasn't supposed to end, ever." Then she'd begun to cry in the sort of loose, phlegmy way that distantly reminded Faith of when Lincoln had been a little boy with croup. Faith had listened, and while she hadn't offered any prescriptions, she'd told Greer that she was welcome to come in and talk whenever she liked. "I mean it," she'd said, and she did mean it, because Greer was one of the good ones. She had come far. She was sterling, loyal, smart, modest, exactly the right person to have hired and promoted. But now Greer was flagging and needed to be reminded of why she was here at Losi, 4 years in. Give her this, Faith thought. Plus, Lincoln was right. Faith was tired and overworked. She was 71 years old, and though some people said that 70 was the new 40, it wasn't. This massage today was desperately needed. She wished she could stay on this table for 6,000 minutes with this compact woman pounding her back and placing a line of hot, clicking stones up and down her spine and massaging her neck with baby oil until it was just a loose string gently connected to a head that felt as light as a balloon. Faith was sick to death of the pace she'd been keeping, and she couldn't bear to go speak at another Losi summit so soon, not the kind of summits that these had become. No more psychics, no more pelican butter. Let Greer do this one. It would be a symbiotic touch. All of this was what Faith thought about as her masseuse went to the other end of the table and began to rub her feet. Sue pressed a particular place under the big toe, and Faith startled, then composed a list with two items on it. 1. Arrange meeting with Greer to discuss L.A. Be sure to find out if Greer speaks Spanish, which would be a help. 2. Encourage Greer Kadetsky generally. She still needs encouragement. They all do. Faith vaguely recalled their first meeting, back at Greer's college campus. Greer had been so bright and filled with feeling, but beyond that, she had also been upset with her parents. Of course, Faith had been reminded of being upset with her own parents at that age. Both sets of parents had held their daughters back, even as they loved them. Faith had been touched, seeing this in Greer, and who knew why you were impelled to do anything you did. But Faith gave Greer Kadetsky her business card, the way she sometimes still gave it out to young women, smiling at them in a way that she hoped would have significance. And apparently it did, for Greer was still here all these years later. And Faith, indisputably an old woman now, still thought about her own mother and father with a tender-hearted bunching up of feeling, despite their unfairness toward her over a half-century earlier. They hadn't known better. They were of their time. She could still almost cry now, recalling their gentleness, and all the games of charades they'd played, and how she and Philip had run around the Bensonhurst apartment after a bath, squealing and smelling good, finally being caught up in a towel held out by their mother like a toreador. They had left their wet footprints everywhere, though they dried fast and left no trace. Her parents had held her back, maddeningly, but just for a while. Her brother hadn't taken her side, and she'd held it against him at first, and then after she'd stopped holding it against him, life had taken over, her life, which was so different from his. And finally, it was as if they'd barely ever been siblings, let alone twins. Lying on the table, she tried to make a note to be the one to call him on their birthday in a few months, and not the other way around. Get a jump on the day and be the one to call him, asking him if he and Sidell were planning to come east soon. I'd really like it if you did, she would say. And we can even play charades, so start practicing. Suddenly, the hands working on her body began to chop, moving with vehemence up and down over these old bones that had been everywhere, and maybe were starting to slow down. Done, cried Sue the masseuse, and she slapped Faith's legs with her two forceful hands, the sound ringing out as if in triumph. Chapter 9. The afternoon of the speech at the mentorship summit in L.A. was dipped in heat, despite the fact that it was early December. L.A. was heat and smog and noise, but none of that was felt or talked about inside the cultural center, which was its own self-contained ecosystem. Heat and smog and noise had been replaced by a subtle veil of scent and an ineffable sensation of cool. Also, the event was lacking long, wearying lines because all the bathrooms, including men's rooms, had been opened up. Women powered easily through. Have I died and gone to heaven? One woman asked another at the hand dryers, which seemed to whir more pleasingly than usual. Drinks and canapes were circulating in the lobby. Slender Bellinis and gemological tuna tartare slicked with yuzu gelée. There was a discreet manicure station here, where women sat with fingers spread. Here and there other women openly nursed infants, and no one looked askance. The feminist psychic held sway in a corner. The women here were wealthy and progressive, believed in equality, gave money to left or center-left candidates, and bought tickets to events like this one to see the roster of speakers, including the female film actors and directors. The audience was well-dressed. It was a sea of soft pastel and the occasional basic black, because even though this was California, New York roots ran deep. Clavicles were exposed, understated jewelry on display, and the conversation took place in voices of concern, interrupted by a couple of familiar shrieks that you might hear in a restaurant when there's a large group of women at a table. Everyone here knew that shriek, which signaled the happiness of women spending time together. Greer Kadetsky and Lupe Ajurieta stood together watching the scene. They had flown there from New York the morning after Lupe had arrived from Ecuador. Lupe, pretty, early 20s, in a yellow dress, was exhausted from the long trip and overwhelmed by the number of people in attendance. Greer said, "Do you want something to eat?" Pleased to be able to use the high school Spanish that she had studied back in Macapie, and took her over to one of the runway-long buffet tables, but the food must have looked so strange to this young woman from Ecuador. It looked strange to Greer, too. High-end, fussy food. "No," said Lupe, in the world's softest voice, which reminded Greer of her own voice back at the beginning of everything. It wasn't that she was loud now, but she was different. A tech guy found them and said, "It's time to get you both mic'd. We're starting in 15. Backstage in the green room before the talk, the tech guy brought out some equipment and said, "Who wants to go first?" Greer tried to explain to Lupe what would happen. Before she could finish what she was saying, the tech guy had reached a hand inside the collar of Lupe's dress to clip on a microphone, which made her tense and gasp. "It's okay," Greer said,
though she knew it wasn't for Lupe, but he had moved too fast. Then his hand withdrew, and Lupe breathed out in relief. She was the most frightened person Greer had ever met, and she had sat in silence throughout the flight from New York to L.A. Presumably, she'd also sat that way during the very long flight from Quito to New York, her first airplane trip ever.
"Are you okay?" Greer asked her now.
"I am well," Lupe said,
but she didn't look well. Greer didn't feel very well herself. She hadn't wanted to give this speech at all. When Faith had offered it to her in October, she'd thought she was kidding.
"Come into my office," Faith had said.
Greer had entered the white space and taken in the walls that had been breaded bit by bit with photos of girls and women.
"Greer," said Faith, "it's your time."
Faith told her that she wanted her to travel to L.A. to appear on stage with one of the young women from Ecuador in order to introduce her and write her speech for her, and then also write and deliver the keynote mentorship speech herself.
"I can't do that," Greer said, shocked.
"Why not?"
"I don't give speeches. I write them for other people. Or I used to, anyway. Short ones."
"Anyone who ever gave a speech," said Faith, "was once someone who didn't. You're what now, 25?
26.
Well, it's definitely time." Greer wondered why Faith was giving her this gig. She remembered something Faith had said to the team once, early on. "Men give women the power that they themselves don't want." She'd meant power to run the home, to deal with the children and their friends and teachers, to make all decisions about the domestic realm. So maybe Faith, like one of those men, was giving Greer something she didn't particularly want. Maybe Faith had no interest in giving this speech, and so that was why she was giving it to Greer, passing the power on to her in order to get rid of it. Greer saw, at that moment, Faith glance toward her minimalist desk clock, like a therapist, nearing the end of the hour. Greer had overstayed her welcome. Why hadn't she just said yes?
"Okay, great. It's a deal,"
Greer said, with forced liveliness.
"Shoot me now,"
she added, putting her finger to the side of her head and trying to laugh. The bad moment had fled. All you ever had to do to make a bad moment flee was acquiesce. This was true everywhere in life, even though so much of Losi's focus was supposedly on not acquiescing. She stood to leave, and Faith looked up at her and said,
"It'll be a good thing, I promise."
The dozen or so times Greer had come into that office over the years, unrelated to work, had been because Faith had seen that something was wrong and had called her in, or else because Greer had felt welcome. Faith had encouraged her to come in and talk whenever she wanted. After originally telling Faith about her Corey problems, Greer had returned to her office months later, after a weekend up in Macapi during which Corey had broken up with her.
"I love you, and I'll always love you," he'd said stiffly, like someone in a school play. "And I really don't want to hurt you. But I just can't do this anymore."
Faith comforted her in the aftermath and told her that the best thing you could do in a hard moment in your life was work.
"Work can help," she'd said, "especially when you're suffering. Keep writing those speeches for those women, Greer. Keep imagining their lives, what they go through. You'll find yourself going outside yourself and into them. It'll provide perspective. And any time you want to talk to me, let me know." That was 3.5 years earlier. Over time, in their broken-up state, Greer and Corey spoke far less frequently, and now she was only in touch with him on the occasions when she went home to visit her parents in Macapi. As each year since their breakup passed, and they moved farther away from each other, she was able to see, objectively, that Corey had turned into a tall, skinny, grown man who lived in his mother's house with a plastic-covered sofa and video games and a turtle. The sensation she experienced each time she saw him there, him, living like this and turning into this new and different person, was as strong as a flare-up of a chronic illness. Since the breakup,
Greer had had occasional relationships and hookups that were mostly decent and once or twice excruciating. She sometimes met someone for after-work drinks at the kind of bar where everyone was young and worked for progressive startups or for culture websites with names like Topsoil. By age 26, Greer had finally developed a lasting look. The blue streak in her hair had been rinsed away a few years earlier, replaced by highlights, but her eager, sometimes sexy nerdiness remained, and it had become fully stylish. Chunky eyeglasses were in. She wore those glasses, and often a short skirt and bright tights and little black boots, whether to show up at work or attend a loci event or go out for drinks in a cluster at night. Sometimes the drinking people gathered on the Skillet, a former lighthouse party boat moored on the Hudson downtown. The surface shifted beneath her feet as she drank and shouted and flirted. Since becoming single, Greer had forced herself to get good at flirting. The men she met all seemed to say they were several years out of Wesleyan. Their beds were never made, or else made poorly, when she climbed into them. No one yet had the time or inclination to take care of themselves, and it was unclear when that would ever begin. 2 months before the L.A. summit, on board the Skillet, Ben Prochnauer from the office had opened himself to Greer like some kind of obstinate flower. They stood close together, the way he had once stood with Marcella Boxman, she who was long gone from loci, on to be a social innovation fellow at Cambridge, and he spoke urgently to her. "So, do you ever think of me that way?" he asked. "That way?" Greer stood back and looked at him. They had been working together for so long. In the early years, he had flirted with her, but it had seemed like little more than a reflex. Now, with no warning, he was genuinely hitting on her. His face had the glinting optimism of a found coin. Greer slept with him that night on the futon in his studio apartment in Fort Greene. The surprise hookup was the sort of event that the two people in question suspect they will look back on one day with vague, sentimental affection, overlooking the sadness that had gotten them there. When it was time for her to go on stage that day in L.A., Greer walked out, mic'd and lightly quivering, her vision darting around in the darkness as if she were a goldfish who'd been poured into a new bowl, while outside the bowl loomed 1,000 invisible women. Nearby on the stage stood the sign language interpreter, patiently waiting. The room stayed quiet, with just the occasional obligatory and somehow recognizably female cough, followed by scrabbling in a purse for a lozenge, which was unwrapped in a quick sequence of rustles. "Please forgive me if I seem a bit freaked out at the moment," Greer began. "Most of the speeches I give are in my head." There was warm laughter. "I wouldn't be here," she said, "if it weren't for Faith Frank." Applause. "She is the best, and she wanted me to come in her place. I know you'd rather hear her speak, but you've got me. So, Faith Frank hired me originally based on nothing. She took me in, and she taught me things, and more than that, she gave me permission. I think that's what the people who change our lives always do. They give us permission to be the person we secretly really long to be, but maybe don't feel we're allowed to be. Many of you here in this room, can we actually call this a room? It's more like a landmass. Probably had someone like that, didn't you?" There was affirmative murmuring. "Someone who gave you permission. Someone who saw you and heard you, heard your voice. We're all really lucky to have had that." Then Greer introduced Lupe, speaking of her hardship and bravery, and how proud Loci was to have helped her and the rest of the young women. "Now, starting over after a traumatic time," Greer said, "she's been connected with her own mentor, a woman in her country who is teaching her everything she knows." Lupe appeared on stage and took her place beside Greer.
She took out a little folded piece of paper on which was the Spanish version of the words that Greer had written for her. Lupe smoothed down the page and giggled in her lovely way. The crowd in response was warm and understanding. Finally, Lupe began to read aloud, slowly and carefully. Then Greer read the same words in English. I speak today for myself and the others who were there in Ecuador when we had the bad experience. We left our homes, and it was not what they said it would be. We were afraid. They wouldn't let us leave. Back and forth they went, conveying the emotional story about how Lupe had been living a bleak life that did not seem like it would ever get better. Lupe looked so frightened and upset as she recalled what had happened to her that Greer felt that way too, just as she had felt when she wrote those lunchtime speeches. She reached out instinctively and took Lupe's hand, holding it as Faith had once held hers. In her high school Spanish, she whispered to Lupe to take her time, to not worry about a thing. The audience would wait. They weren't going anywhere. So Lupe took her time. And finally, together, going back and forth, she and Greer got to the part about how she and everyone else had been rescued and taken away from the neighborhood in Guayaquil where they had all been forced to live. And then, once she was resettled, how an older woman had come to see her and invited her to learn some new skills. Lupe had agreed to go. Together they went to a building where there were computers and people who taught English. I am learning, Lupe said in English, and the audience clapped. There was also a room in the building filled with sample equipment to make textiles. Lupe was shown how to use a hand loom and also how to knit. Her mentor had sat with her in the corner by the window and showed her some different stitches. I have gotten good at this. Later, said Lupe, we want to form a women's textile co-op. Her short statement was done. Lupe had gotten through it. Greer put her arms around her, and the applause began. Later, Greer would find out that a few different women had been holding up their iPhones to record the speech. If the 21st century taught you anything, it was that your words belonged to everyone, even if they actually didn't. It wasn't that the moment had been that special, but for the people in the room it was. You had to be there, women would probably say to one another after showing the clip to friends. An earnest moment between two women on stage at a feminist summit was not much of a big deal. It didn't go viral, unlike the speech given later that same day by the female action star. The women at the summit had all stood at the beginning and end of that one, celebrating the Australian heroine from Gravitas 2, The Awakening, which had become so huge. In a now stupidly famous scene in the movie, her character, Lake Stratton, had said to a gang of corporate supervillains and their henchmen after being mocked by them for being female, "It's true. I may not be in position of balls, beat. So I borrowed a couple." And just then, two enormous wrecking balls swung through the window of the skyscraper office where the standoff was taking place, instantly killing the villains. What mattered about that movie was not its content, which was puerile. It seemed that in order for a female to have a huge cultural moment, it helped if she had a not overtly feminine name and was a hot, front-loaded, violent wench. What mattered really was that the movie had taken in $335 million. And maybe in the future, movie studios would develop more films with female stars. Greer's moment on stage with Lupe wasn't like that. It was smaller and fleeting, but the applause went on for a very long time. Afterward, out in the lobby, a cluster of women surrounded the two of them, encircling them with enthusiasm and questions. I loved what you had to say about how there are people who give us permission, one woman said to Greer. I know what you mean, because I had exactly that experience. Across the way, a middle-aged woman approached Lupe and pulled something from a bag. This is for you, the woman said,
and she pressed upon Lupe a lump of white wool and a pair of needles, to which was attached the beginnings of some sweater or blanket.
"I'm a knitter, too," said the woman in a too loud voice, as though that would help Lupe understand. "But I'd like you to have it."
Lupe took the needles and wool, but Greer didn't know what happened next, for she was carried off on one wave of women, while Lupe was carried off on another. One woman said to Greer, "My person wasn't a teacher. She was a neighbor, Mrs. Palmieri. I took care of her cat sometimes when she went away. She would invite me in when she was home, and we'd talk about cooking. She gave me a lot of advice."
"Mine," said another woman, "was actually my grandfather, an amazing person. He was a tail gunner in the Korean War."
After the event was over, Greer said to Lupe, "You were so wonderful. They really loved you." The young woman looked shyly away. Was she pleased or just self-conscious? It was hard to tell. Greer remembered something that Faith had said during her speech in the Ryland Chapel. She had told them that if they said what they believed, then not everyone would like them or love them.
"If it's any consolation at all," Faith had said, "I love you."
Could that have been true? Yes, Greer thought. It probably had been, because right now she felt a kind of love for Lupe Azurieta. And Greer knew Lupe as little as Faith had known everyone in that chapel. After the building had cleared, Greer and Lupe went back to their rooms in the hotel, which were connected by a door that they didn't open at first. Greer lay down on the king-sized bed and Skyped with Ben back in New York. He had slept over twice in the last week. Their relationship had no propulsion, but it felt physically relieving, his body pleasurably heavy on her like a weighted blanket, his hands and mouth resourceful and in motion.
"I think they liked it," she said to him now.
He came close to the screen, the camera giving him a fisheye lens convexity that made her think about Skyping with Corey over the years. At Princeton, with his messy room behind him, and in the Philippines in the middle of the night, while afternoon blazed in America. Ben's face on screen was still not entirely familiar, though they had slept together a number of times.
"Great job," Ben said. "I watched the live feed with Faith and a couple of people from upstairs," he said. "We all thought you were great, and it was very emotional, that moment with the girl."
A text appeared from Faith a little later.
"Nailed it. Thank you again. You are the best. XXFF.
A little while later, Greer quietly knocked on the door that separated her room from Lupe's. She used her high school Spanish to ask whether Lupe wanted to get an Uber with her and go into L.A. for dinner. There was a long pause, and maybe Lupe's response was one of dread. Maybe she would have preferred to be alone tonight.
"Or we could stay in," Greer quickly added.
Then the bolt was slid, the door opened, and the two of them stood looking at each other.
"But I mean, we should celebrate," she said. "You were amazing out there."
Lupe had done something today that she had never done in her life, gone on stage and spoken before an audience. Lupe nodded, unsmiling. "Is it okay if I come in?"
"Okay."
Greer entered the room, which looked barely occupied. A little orange suitcase was splayed open on a table, revealing the small collection of clothes and belongings that had made the trip here from so far away. Greer wanted to tell her to occupy more space, to drape her modest things around the room, to ask for more, and in so doing, to become more. But you couldn't make someone be that way, especially after a lifetime of poverty and then a year of trauma. The world had failed her. Now it was turning. "Don't be dispirited," Greer wanted to say, but that would have been demanding, not listening. They ordered dinner from the menu. That was an ordeal. Who knew what Lupe thought she was getting? Then, when it arrived, they ate it while watching a pay TV movie about the hostile colonization of the Andromeda Galaxy, a plot so removed from both of their real lives
that it was an equalizer, neither more nor less comprehensible to either of them. Greer sensed at some point that maybe she was staying too long. Lupe looked sleepy. Would she actually be able to sleep tonight in this strange